This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
No fluff, no guessing. When CFA Charterholder is on that resume, it means something real. Intensive study, tough exams, relentless drive, true grit, a strong network. Hiring managers get it instantly. The CFA Charter is more than letters after a name. It's proof of discipline, resilience, and integrity under pressure. It shows who you are before you even walk in the room. Explore what the Charterholder Advantage looks like at cfainstitute.org.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Germany is having a fit of the wobbles. Run by a traffic light coalition of Social Democrats, Greens and Liberals, its economy is growing slowly, if at all. And this month's regional elections in the former East Germany, where the far-right AfD party came first in the state of Thuringia, have led to alarm amongst the mainstream national parties. So, is Germany in trouble? If so, how much and why? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we'll talk about the current political situation in Germany and later we'll turn to the economy. With me, I have Constanze Stelzenmüller, who's Director of the Centre on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution in Washington, and Guy Chazan, Berlin Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. Guy Chazan, the far-right AfD party, Alternative für Deutschland party, did well in the recent state elections in East Germany. Can you just explain very briefly for the listener who they are, and are they like the other far-right parties in Europe that the listeners will have heard of, like Marine Le Pen's Rassemblement National in France?
Well, the interesting thing about the AfD is that they're very much not like parties like the Rassemblement National. You have these big far-right parties in Europe, like the RN, that have basically detoxified their brand over the past few years. They've abandoned some of their anti-Semitic baggage. They've tried to become more popular, more appealing to mainstream voters. And with the AfD, you see a sort of different tendency. It started as an outfit created by a bunch of economics professors who were horrified by the Eurozone bailouts. They were basically very, very Eurosceptic, quite conservative, but not necessarily radical in any way. And basically, since then, it's shifted more and more to the right. And it's become more of a kind of ethno-nationalist, xenophobic party, which is really opposed to immigration and has other sort of quite radical positions. But the fact is that despite that, despite their increasing radicalism, they're actually really establishing themselves as a fixture of the German political system, as we saw with these recent elections in East Germany, where they did spectacular. Well.
And just before we move on to some of the causes, Guy, did anybody else do well in these regional elections?
Yeah, I mean, the other big surprise of the elections was the incredible performance of this new party. It's a completely upstart party called the Zara Wagenknecht Alliance. That was founded by Zara Wagenknecht herself, who is this left-wing populist. She is an extremely interesting politician, a former communist, who was very much on the hard left of a hard left party called Die Linke, which she then abandoned to create her own party last year. They did very, very well as well. From a standing start, they got 11.8% in Saxony and they got 15.8% in Thuringia, which is really remarkable for a party that was only set up about 8 months ago.
I love the idea of setting up a party in your own name and then calling it an alliance. Constanze Stelzenmüller, let's talk about some of the causes. Why do you think the AfD's popularity has surged recently and where has it mainly surged?
There are fundamentally, I think, three schools here. One is the culture war school, which is that people really don't care about politics or policies, but what they're looking for is identity and community and a home in a world that has become inimical to strong communities. Their second school is, you know, there are real economic problems. There is real economic inequality. And the third school is that people are overwhelmed by a feeling of losing control over their private lives, watching governments lose control, and a general sense, if I may put it that way, of things falling apart. I think if you look at polling, if you look at the research that's come out of Eastern Germany in particular, which is very interesting in recent years, it's a bit of all three. What I would warn against is sort of a reductionist analysis that says it's only about bad infrastructure, it's only about the culture wars. I think it's a sort of toxic amalgam of these three factors.
Okay, and can we just dig in a tiny bit into who's doing the voting here? The old kind of idea, I think, was that the elderly East Germans resented a bit what had happened at the fall of the wall. But I gather that's not actually the profile of the people who are voting for them.
No, it's not. In fact, in the regional elections on September 1st in Saxony and Thuringia, it was the boomers, as they're called, the older voters, who held back and who prevented a complete rout by the extreme right and the extreme left. It was younger voters in particular who voted strongly for the AfD.
Right. Guy, has immigration cut through in eastern states like Thuringia and Saxony more than it has in the west? And is that because there are more immigrants in the east, or why would that be?
No, I mean, actually, ironically, that's one of the interesting aspects of the AfD's success in eastern Germany is that, I mean, especially in Thuringia, the proportion of foreigners in the population of that state is actually incredibly low. You know, I was talking to politicians in the BSW, Sarah Wagenknecht's party, trying to figure out why that is the case and why there is so much support for parties like the AfD and indeed the BSW. And she said that it's really strong in depopulated areas where the population has really declined very, very sharply since reunification, because there was just a lack of economic opportunities in those places and people moved to the west or they moved to eastern cities like Leipzig or Dresden for jobs. And what happened was, as a result of this declining population, services contracted to such an extent that there's virtually nothing left. The local shop shut down, then the local youth club, the bus services were shrunk, and basically people were just left on their own, couldn't even get to the local town because there weren't buses. They don't see any foreigners because there aren't any foreigners there. But they feel that there's no money for the bus, but there is all this money for integrating foreigners, for giving welfare benefits to asylum seekers and so on. And that message has really, really taken off in these depopulated areas. Apparently, the lower the population, the more thinly populated an area is, the greater the support proportionately for the AfD, especially in places like Thuringia. And that really, to me, explains why the AfD is so popular, even in areas where there is little to no immigration.
What are the AfD's main policies, or do they actually advocate anything to try and solve these difficulties?
Well, essentially, it all boils down to just closing the borders. It's extraordinary how they can, you know, have posters that say, let's close the borders immediately in a regional election where they know full well and the voters know full well that such issues aren't dealt with on a regional level. They're only dealt with on a national level. So local and regional governments have no say over such matters. But still, it resonates with voters and they love that. They love the idea of shutting down the borders, even though that would be a total violation of the Schengen rules that Germany is part of. I think the other thing that is very, very interesting is remigration.
Remigration.
Remigration, which is one of the main sort of policy platforms of the AfD. Now,
A euphemism,
exactly. A few months ago, there was a big scandal where there had been basically reports in the media about a secret meeting between AfD officials and a notorious ethno-nationalist ideologue from Austria, where they discussed plans to deport hundreds of thousands, even those with German passports, anyone basically with a kind of foreign background who they didn't like. The AfD pushed back a lot against these reports, but they triggered enormous demonstrations in big German cities where people were just coming out in the streets saying, you know, no, we can't let this happen. Big demonstrations against the far right. Now, the interesting thing I found in the Thuringian election was in all the rallies I went to, remigration was the slogan. So they kind of backed away from the slogan a few months ago, but now actually in the throng of an election campaign, they were advertising it as one of their main policy proposals. And essentially, they want to deport large numbers of Germans on a really extensive scale.
Constanze, how are the other parties reacting to this? And I suppose part of the answer to the question also lies in, will they form coalitions with the AfD in these states where the AfD is the leading party?
Opposition conservatives, who came out strongest in Saxony and second best in Thuringia after the AfD, are now in the unpleasant situation, having excluded working with the AfD and having excluded working with the old post-communist Die Linke Party, which Sarah Wagenknecht left, and having excluded working with the Greens, now having to pact with Sarah Wagenknecht's new party, if they want to form a government. And I mean, I don't want to bore your listeners with too much coalition mathematics, but I think at this point we are looking at either the opposition conservatives, who very much want to win the national elections next year, in September, either contorting themselves in coalitions with party groupings whose positions they are diametrically opposed to, or in fact a gridlock of ingovernability. And the fear in Berlin and elsewhere in the country is that this will undermine the credibility and legitimacy of representative democracy even more and create fertile ground for extremists in what is clearly now has been the opening shot for the national elections in September 2025.
Right, so it's a really difficult position. Guy, very quickly, what happens if they can't form a coalition? I mean, you can't force the CDU, the opposition conservatives, to form an alliance, a coalition with the AfD, can you? So what happens if nobody can form a government in these states?
It's all terribly complicated, but I mean, there is a solution, but it's messy. And essentially, the real fear is that these states just could, as Constanze said, just become ungovernable. And that is a real, real concern, because you've never had that in post-war German history. It's really quite a unique situation. With Saxony, it's a little bit easier. The CDU could form a coalition, possibly with the BSW, although they'd have to really sort of take a deep breath before they did that, for the reasons that Constanze said. These elections show that forming stable coalitions in Germany on the regional level is going to become more and more difficult. The parliamentary party system is becoming more and more fragmented, and voters are becoming more and more volatile in their behavior as voters. And that is stoking so many problems for the future.
Guy, are the main parties beginning to adopt some of the AfD immigration stances? Because that's been something of a pattern in other countries in Europe.
Yeah, no, absolutely. After a terrorist attack in the western city of Solingen in August, the government very, very quickly adopted some measures to sort of toughen law and order policy, you know, knife bans and things like that, but also sort of cracking down on people who are slated for deportation, cutting their benefits, that kind of thing. That was one thing. And then after the election, just now on the 1st of September, they went even further and started saying that they were going to expand border controls on all of Germany's land borders, which is an extraordinary thing to do, considering the danger that that poses to the whole Schengen system of sort of visa-free travel in the EU. And there's been a lot of pushback from Germany's neighbors over that. So it's extraordinary how immigration now is really the hot button issue in Germany.
Constanze, when are the next national elections and will the coalition hold till then?
The next national elections are set for September 28th, 2025. So within a little over a year. And I have, I think, written a number of columns in which I've pointed out that the German political culture and the constitutional system frown on a government's attempt or the opposition's attempt to call early elections. It is much more difficult politically and constitutionally to do that than, say, in England or in France. That said, I have to say that watching day-by-day politics in Berlin right now, I have been asking myself every morning waking up to the news whether this government can hang in there. They appear at this point to dislike each other so much that they have cancelled coalition meetings, routine coalition meetings. They snipe at each other publicly. The leaders of the opposition snipe at the Greens, whom they have described in the past as enemies, which strikes me as unhelpful given that I think at this point there are five regional governments where the Conservatives are in co-governing arrangements with the Greens, either on their own or with other parties. And also unhelpful and unwise given the choices which would be extremist parties like the BSW, the Bund-Nicht Alliance.
Constanze Stelzenmüller and Guy Chazan. That's the politics. Now for the German economy. To brief us on this, I'm joined by Professor Marcel Fratscher of the Humboldt University of Berlin, who's also president of DIW Berlin, German Institute for Economic Research, and Timo Fetzer, professor of economics at the universities of Warwick and Bonn. Marcel Fratscher, if I can begin with you. Germany is Europe's largest economy. Can you just remind us how it's performed over the last 5 to 10 years?
In the 2010s, German economy was doing really well. Strong growth, German export companies, German industry did really well competing with other companies worldwide. But there was a clear break with the pandemic, or probably even a bit before. And since then, it has been rough going. The German economy has not recovered to the pre-pandemic level. And at the moment, there is a stagnation. The German economy is not growing. And in particular, energy-intensive industry is suffering. That's automotive sector, that's machinery, pharmaceuticals, chemistry. And those sectors, which are very important for the German economy, have been shrinking with very low investment. But now it needs to manage a transformation towards green technologies, towards digitalization. And that's a big challenge they're facing.
Okay, we'll dig more into some of those reasons in a moment. Marcel, can you just fill us in how that compares with the other economies in Europe? Is it broadly the same or is it worse?
So Germany has been outperforming most other Europeans, in particular Western Europe, in the 2010s. Over the last 5 years, it has been lagging behind. And currently, one of the weakest growth rates is in Germany.
Timo Fetzer, we did programs at the time when Russia invaded Ukraine about the dependency that Germany, amongst others, had on Russian energy. How big an impact did the invasion have on the German economy because of what it had to do?
Well, of course, there was a first strong increase in natural gas prices, which, you know, was the main energy import. And so that obviously affected the energy-intensive manufacturers. But there's sort of more indirect shocks hitting households that rely on natural gas for space heating. Also, you know, the oil market was going through some turbulence as well. And there's a lot of fuel oil being used for heating. And so that took an additional hit on households, even though government was sort of trying to support households quite directly. But in terms of the structural shock that this implied, is some firms might have said, well, let's just see whether we can weather the storm, just like previous crises in the previous golden decades, so to say. Now we're in a situation where actually energy prices will remain elevated for the foreseeable future. And actually, they need to remain elevated in order for climate action and sort of the climate transition to actually have bite. And so that sort of puts now companies and the private sector and sort of the German model, you know, in big question as to how that transition can be now shaped and achieved.
Marcel, the overall point there is that there was a significant effect from energy prices. Could we say that Germany has now successfully found other sources of energy, but that those remain at a more expensive level than they were before?
Yes, that's true. Germany has been managing quite well to substitute Russian gas and oil. But as Timo said, it's still more expensive than the rest of, you know, other countries, in particular the United States. So energy is one big factor, but there are two other big factors in this current situation. One is the openness of the German economy, higher dependence on exports. Global trade is not doing well. So the German export companies or industry companies are suffering. And the third factor behind that is the slow technological transformation. Take the automotive sector in Germany. They have been putting their luck on combustion engines, have been too slow in moving to electric cars.
Can we look at the first part of that first, Timo? High dependence on exports. Most countries would love to have a kind of significant dependence on export. Is there any particular reason, any particular country that Germany was exporting to that Germany's consequently had a problem with?
I think Germany is in a very interesting position because it sort of trades heavily with both China as well as the US. And so, of course, for a long time in the last 10 years, German cars were going very aggressively into the Chinese market. And now, you know, without sort of paying that much attention, there's all of a sudden Chinese competitors that are actually offering an alternative platform with electronic vehicles. And so German car manufacturers see a quick sort of loss of their export market.
Is it just car manufacturers or are there other big exports?
So cars are one of the big items. Machinery, plant machinery and equipment, German manufacturing engineering, they are still excels and is very, you know, very prominent with automation systems and so on. But of course, that is something that, you know, is very cyclical investment in plants and machinery, whereas a car manufacturing, you know, car consumption is quite regular. You know, there's a steady flow of households buying new vehicles every 7 to 10 years. And so this is where Germany has been a bit undiversified vis-a-vis, in particular, China. And as I said, and as Marcel pointed out, a bit blindsided on the technology transformation.
Marcel, let's talk about that point now, because one might anticipate that Germany would be highly competitive when it came to, if you like, updating its technology and innovation. And what you're telling us is that's not been true. Why is that the case?
Germany and German companies have, to some extent, been victim of their own success, right? I mean, the automotive sector, huge profits with combustion engines still 10 years ago, and they underestimated the challenge. They simply made a mistake because the previous model was so profitable. If you look at industrial products today, including the car, digital services, software, are increasingly becoming more and more important. And that's where Germany has not been very good. And if they want to build the car of the future, let's say for the automotive sector, they need to become better in those areas as well.
Timo, why is that?
So I think part of it is, I mean, Germany is a complex country, as in, you know, we have the 16 states, a federal government, thousands of municipalities. And a lot of the challenges when it comes to services actually is that it's knowledge intensive companies. So it's startups, it's individuals who have an idea, who sort of implement something. And for that, these firms still need growth capital. And the German financial system in particular is more geared towards giving out loans and securing these loans against capital assets, such as a machinery, you know, to make a car manufacturing plant or whatnot. And that simply doesn't exist when you are in a knowledge intensive service sector production effort. And so lots of smart programmers, coders, you know, they just leave the country to opportunities or markets where that capital is more easily forthcoming, which it oftentimes happens to be actually the UK and to some extent, but much more the US.
Do you mean that German institutions won't put up capital against ideas? They will only put it up against something tangible?
It's much more difficult, I would say, for Germans to raise capital in Germany. Like this sort of ecosystem is not as well developed there. And part of it is also a European issue because capital markets in Europe are not that well integrated. And of course, the problem with services in particular is that services just scale incredibly fast. I mean, you know, it's a lot of these are platform technologies. Think of the Ubers of the world. It's a platform-based business that scales incredibly fast. And of course, when you have a set of 27 countries that each want a piece of the pie, it gets a bit difficult within the European single market. And I think that's where some of the discussions on the economic policy domain are fast evolving in Europe now.
Marcel, are there particular reasons in Germany why there should be problems scaling up in that kind of a way? I mean, is it partly the result of, I don't know, the federal system? Is it partly because the German economy does not actually release enough capital to invest?
Yes, there's other German factors which had a lot to do with a mentality, which since World War II has always been based on checks and balances. So change is very hard to engineer. And what we don't realize in Germany and the UK as well is that our economies are really small compared to the US market or the Chinese market. And Mario Draghi, the former Italian prime minister, came out now with a report saying, look, if you want to compete in industrial products with China and the US, we need to approach it from a European perspective. You need a European capital market union to mobilize capital at the European level. So this is not what's going wrong in Germany. That's what's going wrong in Europe. I mean, Germany is not the only country with these difficulties. The difference is Germany is a lot more dependent on the industry than, let's say, the UK or France.
That's very interesting and actually rather a bleak outlook for Britain. But Timo, one of the things that we discovered in the programme that we made last week about the British fiscal situation, and one of our guests told us that actually Germany faced significant problems because it has such an iron rule about borrowing to invest and about seeking to use borrowings.
The German rule on paper looks actually quite sensible, as in, you know, if the economy hits, a bad patch, the state is allowed to borrow more and sort of inject that cash into the economy. But oftentimes, you know, data is lagging. We don't actually know, are we now in a bad patch or not? And so that makes the state very unresponsive. And then, of course, there's still the transmission, actually bringing that spending to work in the economy that requires an agile public sector. And I think that's exactly where all the issues around the lack of digitization also come in and make that sort of difficult. And this is where the German federal and decentralized settlement, again, causes a lot of issues, which is often what people, international commentators, just, you know, don't understand, that even if there is more money to be spent, you know, who's actually doing the spending and how that is organized. And that sort of triggers a very complex negotiations.
Can I make sure that I understand you correctly, Tim? It's become something of an orthodoxy here in Britain that actually a problem with promoting growth in Britain is that we're too centralized and we don't devolve power enough. But you seem to be saying that actually the problem in Germany is there's too much devolution of power.
It's about smart decentralization, and that requires, for example, free flow of information between central government and devolved administration, and that requires data standards and harmonized IT systems. And that's actually one of the things that has worked a little bit better in the UK, because there's been a push to consolidate some of this digital plumbing in the public sector. In particular, the tax system has done that. In Germany, pretty much every town has its own tax office. Having local administrations and then the federal administration, the state administration, it becomes really, really difficult to implement agile measures such as, for example, investment tax credits that would encourage firms to offset capital spending, to future corporate income tax liabilities. So, you know, that's been a bit of a sticking issue.
Marcel Fratscher, what do you think Germany should and could do in the short to medium term?
The first one is to deregulate, let companies take decisions. That's probably the biggest challenge. If you look at Volkswagen, Germany's biggest manufacturer of cars, they now want to close some plants and lay off a few workers. And the government is dead set against it. So transformation change requires let the company management decide, take decisions, probably in the short term, so over the next year. The biggest hurdle is actually sentiment. The economy, 80% is psychology, is whether people at the company level taking decisions or citizens have trust in government, in the companies, in the future, that whatever they do, whatever they invest, is worthwhile. And so I wish the German government was a little bit more, not a little, a lot more courageous in saying, look, we're in a difficult situation. Let's really push the envelope. Let's really have a major investment initiative. Let's help companies and citizens. And that, in short, is, I think, the best a government can do in the short term over a time span of 1 to 2 years.
Marcel Fratscher there with Timo Fetzer. My thanks to them and to Guy Chazan and Constanze Stolzenmüller. And my conclusion, well, for both political and economic reasons, that election next year sounds like it's a bit of a watershed. And that's the last programme in the current series, but we'll be back again in November. In the meantime, do listen to one of the more than 300 episodes we've made by visiting BBC Sounds and subscribing to the Briefing Room podcast, and you'll get access to the entire back catalogue. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Caroline Bailey, Ben Carter and Kirstine Knight. The editor was Richard Varden and the sound engineer was James Beard.
Humanity's journey to understanding the body has been a gory one, littered with unethical experiments, unintended consequences and unimaginable pain.
In The Human Subject from BBC Radio 4, we investigate the stories of the discoveries that came at great human cost, but ones that also saved countless lives.
I'm Dr. Julia Shaw.
And I'm Dr. Adam Rutherford. And in this series, we're going to investigate the threads connecting modern-day medicine to its often brutal origins.
And reveal the untold stories of the people who endured them.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
Hello, Greg Jenner here, host of You're Dead to Me. In my new family-friendly podcast series, Dead Funny History, historical figures come back to life for just about long enough to argue with me, tell us their life stories, and sometimes get on my nerves. There's 15 lovely episodes to unwrap, including the life of Ramses the Great, Josephine Baker, and the history of football, plus much, much more. So this Christmas, give your ears a treat with Dead Funny History. You can find it in the You're Dead to Me feed on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.